The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
This is Reformation Church History course, and like any church history course, I want us to start out by reflecting a little bit of what church history is all about. And I know this is the next to last day of the first week of classes. The cycle has gotten around that far, but you're probably still sort of getting some of the summer out of your system, not quite into the groove yet. So let's just think a minute. If you were to be given the assignment by the leaders of your local church, either here or your home church, to write a history of that congregation, what kinds of things would you include in your history? Come on, some of them are obvious. Just
when, how it started.
All right, origins, the dates. Yeah, you know I like to know about dates, Sharon. So, that's always important. We're dealing with history, so the chronology is important, so you get the sequence of things right. But you went on to say the people. Mm-hmm. Which kinds of people are you thinking of? Okay. All right. So,
and the people that served.
You usually have when you begin, there's some kind of a core group, a nucleus out of which a new church plant begins, and those people would be very important, even if they didn't go on to be in leadership positions necessarily. And that suggests the kind of people they will most naturally reach too. I myself don't like the so-called homogeneous unit principle of church growth. I don't see that in the book of Acts. Diversity is the thing, but it is true that you usually first contact the people that are similar to you. John, what were you going to say? Okay. The ones who are sort of in visible leadership positions, that would certainly be a kind of thing that you would include. The first pastor. Sometimes you have somebody supplying the pulpit before you have a regular pastor. That's frequently the case with a new church. But obviously the pastor, the preacher, the elders, or whatever that particular body might call the lay leadership. The musicians, that's an interesting. What does that suggest as to another sort of dimension, a facet of the life of the church? You think of music, what else tends, we usually think of music as part of what facet of the life of the church?
Worship.
The worship. So the worship style would be important to consider. What's the focal point of their worship? How do they do it? We have varieties of that in churches that we're probably all acquainted with. And it can vary quite a bit because it often reflects the culture. Different ethnic groups tend to have different styles. Although I must say the Korean music is very much like American church music, I find. Now, if we had some of our students from India give more expression to their worship style, it might be a little different. And I don't know, I haven't talked with the Nigerian students about this, but I suspect their musical expression would be somewhat different. And maybe even the Koreans, when they're away from this context, have different ways of worshiping than we tend to do here on campus. But that's another facet of it. Let's just write some of these down. You've got origins, and we'll include in that development. Sort of the ups and downs of any local church, the people, including the leaders, visible leaders, but also others. It'd be very important to have a sense of the others as well. worship, including the music. What else comes to mind that might be important to include? Yes?
I would include the theological shifts.
Okay, the whole area of doctrine. Let's take the first thing you mentioned as sort of the mission of the church, its conscious motive, maybe philosophy of ministry would get involved there. And a number of things could be included there. But then the whole doctrinal area. Anything else anybody would like to add as to facets, Mark? All right. I like the word crises. Let's use it, though, not only in a negative sense, but in a positive one as well, both. Unusual events that might occur in the life of the church that prove to be turning points of one sort or another. Now, some examples of that could be controversies, a heresy arising in the church that could lead to a split, persecutions outside But then on the positive side, maybe a revival could come and be a very much a crisis sort of thing. Usually when there is a revival, I had one of my former students who had been in the pastorate quite a while told me they had prayed earnestly for revival in his local congregation that he was pastoring, and the Lord brought it. But then the after effects were very difficult to manage. Because you got some people, while there were some people who were very moved by the Spirit and who came to a development of their spiritual life beyond where they had been, others didn't have that and became jealous of what was happening. And it led to very sharp controversy and so on. In the history of revivals, that's usually the case. Some of the most famous denominational splits are in periods of revival. So that tends to come. And this particular pastor said to me, I'm not going to pray for a revival next time. He says it really was too much. I couldn't handle it. And it's sort of like, well, I won't get into that. I think we need to, and this part of the benefit of church history, it should be the study of the history of the church should help us to know the whole context of things. We certainly want to be praying for the Spirit of God to do His thing, whatever that may be. But we realize that often it's far beyond what we anticipate in both the good benefits and the challenges that it brings. And all right, these are some of the things. Can anybody think of other things that would be of concern to include?
Social involvement in the church.
Yes, okay. A church and society or a culture. How to express that effect on society. In the history of the church, most of the earlier history, certainly through the long period of the Middle Ages, included in the Reformation era, there's a very close tie between church and state in European church history. So that we'll talk about that. And today, at least in American culture, they aren't so closely tied. We have a commonly held belief in separation of church and state. But obviously right now, the media are getting into the whole question of the so-called Christian coalition and its effect on politics. But even apart from that, there ought to be a way in which Christianity is influencing the culture. Just by individual Christians having their effect in their normal walk in life and so on. But this could include ministries of mercy, sort of thing that deacons do, as well as the church and state type thing and politics, influence on the intellectual developments, Christian literature, education. Had a vast impact in American society and history. Most of the universities, before the great public universities started developing just in this century, most of the universities were started by churches here in America. Most of them have lost that identity to a very great extent. Well, let's see if there are any other particular things that we ought to include here. I think we've covered the main areas that I had thought of. Now, we put this in the context of local church, but think now of your denominational affiliation, and if you were going to write a history of the denomination, pretty much the same areas would come into play. And but you might then begin to think on a broader scale. And when you start to think of the church as a whole, all of Christianity, all those people that we expect to meet and enjoy in heaven, the people who really love the Lord are trusting Him for salvation, no matter what label they happen to wear. I think there'll be many Catholics in heaven, for example. While I differ with their doctrine and their teaching, I think there are some people, and this is probably true in all of our orbits, good or bad, some people who wear a certain label and profess certain things, but it isn't what they really believe when you get right down to it. It isn't where their heart is. And the Lord knows that. But I feel just because of the size of the Roman Catholic Church, it's very likely that there'll be more of them in heaven than Presbyterians, let's say. Very, very certainly possible, even though it might be only a fraction of the entire group. But it begins, when you start looking at it that way, you see, then you start thinking more globally, and you realize there are a lot of different, certainly in the area of worship, a lot of different ways of doing it. We're going to, we tend as Reformed people, at Westminster is identified as with the Reformed faith, and that's what we'll get at in the Reformation history to a great extent. We tend to define ourselves in terms of doctrine. That's usually what we put up front. You know, you can be part of this particular fellowship if you adhere to the 5 points of Calvinism, or you can subscribe to the Westminster Confession of Faith, or whatever. But as I just said, we realize that there are plenty of believers, brothers and sisters in Christ, who, for whatever reason, they haven't studied it, they haven't seen those documents, they haven't emphasized the same parts of Scripture as they've studied it, who might have other creeds or confessions. And we'll find that there are going to be a lot of those. I have been the PCA's representative to the National Association of Evangelicals for the last 8 years or so. And I'm no longer the one on the executive committee and board, but it's been very interesting to me to be part of that wider group of people who have a confessional statement of about 12 points, emphasizing the inerrancy of Scripture and the cardinal elements of the gospel, these substitutionary atonement of Christ, His deity, His second coming, His resurrection, all those things that we would adhere to. But a good many of them would be more out of the Arminian camp, many of them out of Pentecostal groups. The largest group in there is the Assemblies of God. And you get to the convention annually, and then the, three or four times a year, the small groups, and you find tremendous fellowship with these people. You really feel at one. There's no question about the mutual love for the Lord. So we begin to think that way about the whole church, and then think of our ethnic differences, the different parts of the world, and the providence of God that the gospel has gotten to, and how simply because of the different culture, in a way this reflects the effect of Christianity on society, but there are different insights. Just the way people understand human nature. Now, in the period that we're going to study, we won't probably see so much of that because it's more confined to a European context. But we still want to be considering that. What was the Lord doing, really, in these two centuries, roughly 1500 to 1700, that had global impact? As we look at Luther, who never got very far at least in the major time. He got down to Rome earlier in his experience, but he was basically, because he was a hunted criminal in the view of the Holy Roman Empire, basically stayed in Saxony. And yet this Saxon peasant has had probably a huger impact on the whole world than any other individual in the history of the world, than Jesus Christ, maybe the Apostle Paul. That's a fair statement, I think. Others might want to make such claims for Karl Marx or somebody else, but his ideas have had a fantastic impact all around the world. Not immediately, but over the course of time. So we'll want to think about the whole global development as it stems from this 16th century. Well, that's just enough to get you your thoughts stimulated as to what this course might accomplish in our experience together this semester. Let's just go down the second sheet there that gives the course description and specific objectives and methods that I'll be using. We have these four things that we're trying to accomplish in this course: a knowledge of the main events and people in the course of the church's history during the era of the Protestant Reformation in the 16th and 17th centuries. And this, of course, fits with some of the things we were discussing earlier and put on the board. Second, a grasp of the development of Christian thought and of the formulation of the church's doctrine, including the errors that have challenged biblical doctrine. The book by Jaroslav Pelikan will be particularly helpful in that regard, Christian Tradition, Volume 4. Third, an understanding of leading figures in the life of the church in order that the student may have some models with whom to identify in the Lord's service. This has been one of the most beneficial things to me of the study of church history. You sometimes wonder, what is all this going to be worth to me? And you might get a few sermon illustrations out of church history and so on. But really, it's much more part of our sanctification. Dr. Davis likes to say that we in church history are in the wisdom business. You've heard him say that, I imagine. And it is true. It's sort of like the benefit of study of church history, sort of like having an uncle or somebody that you admire who's slightly older. He's had more experience and is willing to share that experience with you, and you can benefit by that vicarious experience. Experience is the best teacher, but it'd be awfully hard if we all have to learn just by the hard knocks we take in life and can't learn from the experiences of others. So that's part of what this is about. And I found myself, I like a biographical approach to church history, and there are certain people that I can identify with, and I find I go back to them again and again. Very useful that way. Just think of some of the Bible characters. Peter, David, Moses, John, there are a lot of them that we can relate to readily. And as we see Christ formed in them, it helps us to gain from that too. And then the fourth thing, a sense of God's providence as it is seen working in the overall pattern of the church's history. That's really the most important thing. We don't always get to deal with that as we go along through the semester. But as you gain insights into that, don't hesitate to bring it up in class for the benefit of the rest of us. As I lecture, I'll sometimes bring that out, but often you can't. It takes almost a lifetime of study to begin to appreciate all that's there. We work by extrapolation from what's in the scriptures. My own devotional reading's been in Chronicles lately, and 2 Chronicles just has a lot of direct applications. The writer takes these different kings and the ones who were faithful to the Lord and the ones who weren't, and you often see the chastisement of the Lord upon that leader and the people of God because of their leader's failings right there, right then and there. The Lord doesn't wait with his own children. Judgment on the unbelievers often takes time. God doesn't always deal with them in this life even. He can wait till the day of judgment. But his own children he usually deals with pretty quickly for the sake of our learning the lessons. But to see then the kinds of lessons we get in biblical history also in the history of the church. Obviously, we don't have an inspired version of it. Roland Bainton, Jaroslav Pelikan are not inspired. You'll find many places where you can take issue with them and differ with them, and you ought to. Your teacher's not infallible by any means. So we can have some good give and take on how we interpret some of these things and where we see the hand of God going. And I hope we can all know better, even where we might differ in our view of it. So those are the things that I'm hopeful this course will accomplish in your experience. As to methods, two main channels, the lectures that I'll be offering, and then the books and other materials. I wish technology or something could get us so history could be studied other ways. We do have films and videos that can be used, and we may have time to use some of those. We'll wait a little bit to see how the semester unfolds. I don't want you holding back in discussion in hopes that I'll bring you a movie before the semester's over. Yeah. But we'll just see how that works out. There are some available that are of interest and help one to learn and appreciate the material. But basically, when you're studying the past, we don't yet have time machines that can take us back there to see these things as they unfold. I think that's part of what's going to happen at the Day of Judgment, by the way, since Dr. Davis referred to that day in chapel today. And I'm looking forward to that aspect of it. I'm sure I'll be embarrassed by some of it, too. But we have to rely on books. And so there is a good bit of reading here. The people read at different rates of speed, too. So I want you to know that I'm open to give you help on that score. We usually figure it's fair to expect 2 hours of work for every hour in class. So it's a 3-hour course, so basically 6 hours of work per week outside of class. If you find that the reading is taking you more than that amount of time, come talk to me about it. And I'll try to prioritize the following readings for you so you get the more important parts. If you're not spending 6 hours, don't come talk to me about it. That's part of the deal. So you're expected to put that much in. The reading is important, and it's a mixture of what we call secondary sources, like Bainton and McNeil and Pelikan, and primary material, Luther himself, Calvin himself, the Westminster Standards, 17th century Puritan material, are primary materials that we will be reading. And I never want to teach a history course without using some primary materials, because you don't want to be totally dependent on people who didn't actually live through the events we're describing. And you get a feel for it by reading Luther and Calvin, the Puritans themselves. And any of you who opt to do a paper in place of the essay question on the final exam, that paper must use some primary materials. It's an opportunity for you to get better acquainted with a figure that you weren't able to read in the assigned reading and so on. And that's part of it. Okay. Any questions on any of this? Turn that sheet over, you'll see the list of books on the back of that sheet. And might just say a little bit about each one of these. Bainton he's no longer living now, but he was a Congregationalist turned Quaker. And one of the, taught at Yale for a long time, one of the things you'll find in all of Roland Bainton's works that I'm familiar with is an emphasis on the development of toleration, religious liberty, and peace. And that comes through definitely in the book we're using. As you can see from the edition we're using, Spitz, who writes the introduction, which is not part of the required reading, but you might find it interesting to do that, Spitz, by the way, has a Missouri Synod Lutheran background, and is it's by Pelikan himself, not Spitz. The Pelikan also has a Missouri Synod Lutheran background, it turns out. It shows the value of this particular work some 33 years after it was first produced. It was first written in 1952. And Bainton, I think Pelikan was one of the advisors to the Martin Luther film produced in the 50s. But Bainton, I think they based a lot of it on Bainton's Here I Stand, his biography of Luther. And this book then came out nearly that time. And now after a generation has gone by, they reissued it in 1985. And still highly regarded, even though there's some Reformation scholarship has gone beyond where he was at certain points. It's still the most readable, compact version of Reformation history that I know of. And he always has these lovely contemporary woodcuts from the period that illustrate, again, give you a feel just like reading primary materials. John T. McNeil also has passed on, I believe, a Canadian, taught for some years at Union Seminary in New York. That perhaps suggests some of his bias. It comes up at the end of his book on the history and character of Calvinism, where he talks about Dr. Machen. You can see he didn't agree with Westminster's stance, but he was a man of genuinely ecumenical spirit and a very great expert on the Reformed tradition, on Calvin, on Zwingli, and so on. So that book is valuable. You won't find it quite as readable as Bainton, a little bit heavier. But for the Reformed tradition, there's really no other book that I know of that accomplishes what it does. It fits with this course very well. Pelikan, as I mentioned, he's still living. A couple of years ago, he lectured over at Lutheran Seminary, and I took a bunch of students to hear him. Amazing man in his knowledge of languages and grasp of the history of doctrine. And if you've used, I use Volume 1 in the Ancient Church course, and I think Dr. Davis has used Volume 3 in the Medieval. Volume 2 is more on the Byzantine Church, and now there's a fifth volume on the Modern Age. But Pelikan, relatively conservative Lutheran, although he's moved away from his Missouri Synod roots and certainly wouldn't hold to inerrancy of Scripture and so on anymore, but has an appreciation of the Reformed tradition as well as the Lutheran tradition. Treats it fairly. You can test that out as we go through Volume 4, but I think he does. And you look in the annotated bibliography and you get some sense of his grasp of the literature, including things written in Central European languages that most of us don't know. The time we went over to Lutheran to hear him, they had a little reception after his lecture. And a bunch of us just stayed in the room where he'd given the lecture, and everybody went over to this other place and then came back for him to answer questions. And he got back ahead of the crowd because apparently this man from some Central European country wanted to confer with him, and they happened to sit down right in the row in front of where we were sitting. And here Pelikan was jabbering away in this language. It could have been Polish, or I don't know just what it was, but he has a mastery of some of that material, which means that he has a great appreciation of the whole Eastern Orthodox tradition beyond what most of us in the Western world, Catholic or Protestant, would tend to have. And that ecumenical spirit shines through, and sometimes in ways that I would not fully agree with, but he's certainly somebody to listen to. The other primary materials listed there we'll get into. Luther's Christian Liberty, if time allows today, I'll be referring to that among his three great treatises of 1520. I think it's the outstanding expression of what was the essence of Luther's rediscovery of the gospel. And if you haven't read this before, it's must reading. You just ought to have the chance to hear Luther express himself, actually addressed to the Pope. Introduction, the foreword to it. Calvin's Golden Booklet of the True Christian Life, the bookstore informs me, is back ordered. Baker is out of stock. And that's not as bad as it might be, because this is the same as Book 3, Chapters 6 through 10 of the Institutes. And so how many of you do own the Institutes, Calvin's Institutes? Okay, that's helpful. I asked the library to put some copies on reserve because the bookstore tells me this won't come in until late October and the assignment is mid-October. So we'll hope that maybe they'll come in a little quicker. I like this little paperback edition. It's an older English translation of Calvin, but it's so inexpensive. I've used it to give to people who have a particular impression of Calvin, and this tends to correct that impression. It's really Calvin at his devotional best. But it's right there in the Institutes, so if you have a copy of the Institutes, you don't have to worry about the lack of this particular thing in the bookstore. It's actually printed on the front in the assignment for October 4. You can see it equals Institutes 3, 6 through 10. The Westminster Confession of Faith and Catechisms, I would expect that a majority of you, that may not be the case, but a majority of you may eventually be seeking ordination in a Presbyterian church that has these standards as their official doctrinal standards. So we'll urge you to memorize a few shorter catechisms that you answers that you may not have learned before. But if for the class in general, whatever your background, the Westminster standards have had a very wide influence in not just Presbyterian circles, but Baptist circles, the London Confession, and then the Philadelphia Confession. Those are 18th and, late 17th century and then 18th century standards, were the official Baptist statements of doctrine of the particular Baptists, that is the Calvinistic ones. The general Baptists have become more prevalent, just as Arminian ecclesiastical groups have become more numerous in America, perhaps reflecting some of the democratic trends of culture. But Congregational, Cambridge Platform of Massachusetts, Saybrook Platform of Connecticut, the Savoy Statement of the English Congregationalists, all were almost verbatim the same as the Westminster Confession of Faith. So it's extended far beyond just Presbyterian circles and its influence. And in the earlier days, just as in 19th century America, the McGuffey readers were read by almost all children growing up, even the Methodists used the Westminster Shorter Catechism with some modifications, I'm sure. But it's of great value. It reflects the understanding and piety of the Puritan movement as well as anything. I used to have this class read some of Bunyan, His Grace Abounding, which is his own personal description. It's very parallel to Pilgrim's Progress, which is his more literary fictional version. But I came to feel that it really was better to get the Westminster standards in this class as an example of the Puritan movement. I might just say a word about these recommended readings, none of which are required, but so you can assess the value of them. A.G. Dickens, I think, is still living. He's been sort of the dean of English church historians of the Reformation period. And his second edition, revised edition of the work on the English Reformation, I think is the best, captures really the evangelical understanding of it. There's a lot of controversy about the English Reformation, and there's a lot of the historians in England are trying to argue that the vast majority of people in the Reformation era in England remain Catholic, remain loyal to the medieval traditions. Christopher Haig, H-A-I-G-H, is one of the leaders of that school of thought. And there are a lot of people who don't agree with Haig and are arguing it out. We'll get to the English Reformation and talk about that some more, but I think Dickens' book is one for those of you who have special interests in that field would want to own. The new book on William Tyndale is getting very high reviews. It's very expensive. David Daniels' book. He's a professor, I think, at Yale. I have to check again to make sure, but he's an American professor. who is primarily not so much a church historian as he is a scholar of literature. And of course, Tyndale was a translator of the scriptures. But he brings out aspects of Tyndale's life and career that have been largely unexplored. Now, this past year was a, what would it be? It was the 500th anniversary of his birth, I guess. He was born, I think, in 1494. And so there were some conferences on William Tyndale and so on. But this book is very well written and brings out some of the interesting facets about that English reformer. And it costs about $40. I'm sorry to say it's only available in hardback. The Dillenberger editions of Calvin's writings and Luther's writings are in paperback, although the Calvin one's pretty expensive. But you do get a basic, here's the one on Luther's writings, although the newer edition has a nicer cover. I got this some years ago, but you can see the size of it. It's a collection, 500 pages or so, of Luther's key writings. So if you want to explore him more and the collection of Calvin's writings, there are other places to get such things, but it's one of the handier ones to get a better handle on these great reformers. Kittelsen's biography of Luther is one of the most readable ones still in print. The last two names on there are probably the leading scholars of Reformation church history at this time. Heiko Obermann is now out at the University of Arizona. I think he must have moved there for health reasons or something, either himself or his wife, because it's not known for Reformation scholarship especially until Obermann got there. But he's been at Harvard. He's a German. His great work was really to deal with some of the theology on the eve of the Reformation. One of his works is called The Harvest of Medieval Theology, and has put Luther more in a context of the trends of thought leading up to that time, the late 15th century and so on. And then he's done a lot on Luther himself. This particular book, Luther, Man Between God and the Devil, is one of his latest efforts to get at Luther's significance. Obermann is both of these men, I think, come very close to an evangelical stance. I don't know them specifically. I've met Obermann, but I don't really know where he stands theologically. I think he's come out of a Reformed background, actually. But you can read with sympathy most of what he writes. And likewise, Stephen Osmond, who has recently moved from Yale to Harvard a few years ago now. Osmond, while Obermann's emphasis on intellectual history, the history of ideas, Osmond's been one who deals with that, but also with social and cultural history, which has been where the main scholarship of the Reformation historians has been in the last generation or so. A lot of demographic studies, use of statistics, get at who the people were themselves, not just the leaders, but the lay people that the movements were reaching, to see indeed how far down this penetrate into the grassroots of European society. Osmond represents some of the best results of that sort of effort and writes not as you might think of demographics and statistics on, but with the results of that sort of study, with some new insights on not just the church, but family life, for example. One of his books was called When Fathers Ruled, and talks about the impact of the Protestant Reformation on family structures and so on. So a lot of valuable things. This particular book that's recommended is one of his latest. Maybe it's still his very latest one. The other sheet just gives the topics that I'll be lecturing on, give you an idea of where we're heading. It certainly is not comprehensive, probably tends to be more so in the 16th century, so you get some idea of each variety of the groups that came out of the Protestant Reformation. But then in the 17th century, we'll be narrowing down more and more to the specific background of Westminster Seminary and those of us in the Reformed tradition. That may mean also that some of you who don't identify with the Reformed tradition or Calvinistic tradition can think of doing a paper on something that's outside of that tradition. So that's another way to help you to get at your own heritage in this course. How many of you have taken medieval church history here at Westminster? A fair number, it looks like a little better than half, but some of you have not. So I want to use this first part to bring us up to speed together on the background behind the Reformation. Those of you who've had it have probably allowed it to get a little fuzzy in your memories anyway, so that it won't hurt for you to have a little refresher here to bring it back. I think most of us tend to, just out of our church background, tend to look at the Reformation in a vacuum. It's really one of the great revivals. As Protestants, we often make reference to it. Luther is a hero to all of us, and Calvin and the others likewise. It's probably, I would view it as the greatest revival in the history of the church. Not because of any great external manifestations, as you have in some later revivals of an emotional sort, but just in terms of rediscovery of the gospel against great odds when you look at it from a human standpoint in view of what the situation was by around 1500. We tend to see it in a vacuum, and I think it tends to become almost a magical thing. It's as though God said, "Let Luther be," and there was light. Reformation. And it isn't that way at all when you get into it. You'll find that there were other efforts of reform that were going on prior to Luther's time and concurrent with Luther, which did not have the impact that his particular reform had. And on the other hand, you find that you get down to the time of Luther's death, 1546, less than 30 years after the beginnings of it, with the posting of his 95 Theses in 1517, and Luther himself's very discouraged as to just what has been wrought. He had his followers go throughout northern Germany, where the Lutheran Reformation had taken hold, and do a little investigation. How much do the people really know now, since now they have the Bible and been faithful preaching and so forth? The results were devastating. And Luther, he was subject to some psychological depression anyway. Some have tried to interpret him by means of modern psychology. Erik Erikson, the young man Luther, the play by John Osborne is largely based on that psychological study. It really gave rise to the whole approach to history known as psychohistory, where you try to take figures from the past and put them on the couch and psychoanalyze them. And Luther gives us a lot of material for that, largely what's called his table talk, which was in his later days, he would sit around the table with Melanchthon and the others, their steins of beer, and talk about all the amazing things that had happened. And Luther talks a lot about his childhood experiences, his parents, early teachers, and religious experiences that he had in the monastery and so on. So it all is grist for the psychohistorian's mill, but most serious historians really challenge that you can't really take somebody centuries ago and subject them to meaningful psychoanalysis. Although you look for clues, that the psychological side of things is certainly a significant dimension. I've said I like the biographical approach. Well, we have to use the tools that are available for understanding of the personality. So there's some legitimacy there. But Luther was depressed towards the end and had some good reason to feel, well, what has God really accomplished through all this? So it's not like some magical thing that just, boom, exploded and suddenly we have the pure Protestant church and and all the good stuff happens. It never happens quite that way. It didn't in the book of Acts. Didn't in Corinth. Didn't among the Israelites in Moses' day. So we need to have a reality check, and that's part of the benefit of this study. Now, to get the context properly set, I think we need to look at the condition of the church into which Luther was born, the situation there about the turn of the century. He was born in 1483, November. But we'll look at it just in round figures, around 1500, and look at some of the trends that were bringing things up to that time so that we can better understand what the Lord was doing through Martin Luther. So the corruption of the church first, to see what needed reform. As early as Bernard of Clairvaux, and whether you remember it or not, you all know Bernard of Clairvaux, the writer of such hymns as "O Sacred Head Now Wounded," "Jesus Thou Joy of Loving Hearts." One of the great saints of the Middle Ages. He died in 1154, so he's in the middle of the 12th century. Bernard is one of the people Luther greatly admired out of the medieval period. He didn't like Thomas Aquinas, so he was very selective in which ones he looked on as real testifiers to the truth from the Middle Ages. But I want to start with Bernard's sense of things in the middle of the 12th century. This is a period when Europe was suddenly emerging from what we can pretty accurately call Dark Ages. It's a term that's often used for the whole medieval period very unjustly and unlearnedly. There were dark periods. The 7th century was pretty bad. The 10th century was pretty bad. You have that Carolingian period in the 8th and 9th centuries, kind of a flash in the pan, the days of Charlemagne. But then there's a decline in the 10th century. And then things began to improve in the 11th century. And by the 12th and 13th centuries, you really have a high level of civilization in the Middle Ages. But Bernard, who's sort of riding the crest of that recovery of Europe, has some concerns about this revival of European intellectual power, political power, economic power. He sees the spiritual problems involved here. In the century preceding Bernard's time, the 11th century, Europe had really emerged from previous struggles to become the chief purveyor of civilization to the modern world in the West. There were a couple of other choices at that time. There was the Byzantine world. Constantinople, modern Turkey, is where the Byzantine Empire was. You can see this map is showing the period of Luther's life, basically the time of Charles V, who comes into power right at the time the Reformation's beginning, and who retires from being emperor 1556, 10 years after Luther's death. So what you see on this map is pretty much the situation. But before this time, until 1453, the Byzantine Empire had really been far more advanced than Europe. The Greek version of Christianity, the Eastern Orthodox Church, and so on, what we call the Byzantine Empire. It was the remainder of the old Roman Empire. And when Edward Gibbon wrote his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, he takes it all the way down to 1453, because there's a direct continuity from the great emperors of the age of the Roman Empire, a time of Christ, all the way down there for those many, many centuries. And so that was really the more likely place for civilization to be preserved. And the other great civilization was the Muslim civilization. It had subdivided since the days of Muhammad, who died in 632. But then it had expanded rapidly in the century after Muhammad's death. So they came all across North Africa and all the way up here near to Paris, before the grandfather of Charlemagne defeated the Muslim warriors. 732 at the Battle of Tours, Charles Martel defeated the Moor. That's the way to remember that one. But they had come all the way through here, and you really have this sort of crusading spirit in Spain all the way down to 1492, which is the discovery of the New World under Columbus's efforts, because it took that long for the Christian people in Spain to drive the Muslims across the Straits of Gibraltar back into North Africa. And here, 1453, the Ottoman Turks had then conquered Constantinople, the first time it had really fallen, except for the Fourth Crusade in 1215, very briefly, when the Western Crusaders had conquered Constantinople. But the Ottoman Turks then, all through Luther's life, are a threat to Germany, the heartland of Europe. And they got up as far as Vienna, right here. Here's Vienna. Here's Wittenberg, where Luther was. And you can see it's another great civilization that had strong thinkers, philosophers, scientists. A lot more science was preserved through Islamic civilization than through what we normally think of as Western civilization through that medieval period. But it's Europe that emerges, really starting in the 11th century, and by Bernard's time is beginning to really take the lead. The First Crusade, which was in the 1090s, right around the time Bernard was born, and he became one of the great promoters of the Second Crusade in the 1140s. But the Crusades are symbolic of this fact that Europe's now beginning to move out and affect other parts of the world. It was basically, the motivation was to recapture Jerusalem from the Muslims and rescue the Holy Land for Christianity. It didn't matter to most of them how many people were slain in the process. It's war, it's bloody conquest is what it is. The Crusades, I dislike the term crusader for that reason. So I don't think it was a genuine Christian impulse. But here is the political and military revival of Europe with the church leading the way. More specifically, the papacy, which really had come to gain control of European Christianity by the time of Bernard. It was really the main influence in medieval society, starting with the so-called investiture controversy. If you've had medieval church history, you may remember Gregory VII, the Pope who had been the monk, Hildebrand, in his battle with Emperor Henry IV of the Holy Roman Empire. And the issue of investiture was who gets to select these great noble leaders of society. Not just the barons and earls and counts, but the church leaders, the abbots of monasteries and the bishops of the great territories, because these were territorial political leaders as well. And Pope Gregory VII was insisting the church must make that selection. Henry was insisting, these people are going to be part of my political allies. I've got to pick the ones who will be loyal to me. So you have that sort of church and state conflict, and the church comes through that really exercising its discipline to influence even the kings and emperors of the day. When knowledge increased, and this is the age when the great universities are founded, Oxford and Cambridge in England are founded in the 12th and 13th centuries. University of Paris, University of Bologna, others in Italy and on the continent of Europe come out of this medieval period. And here's this great knowledge that's beginning to develop. A lot of it derived from the Islamic philosophers and so on. But the basic effort of scholasticism was to achieve a reconciliation, a harmony of faith and reason. And for Thomas Aquinas, who's the greatest of these scholastic theologians, it's a harmony of Augustine, or the scriptures, And Aristotle, who was the philosopher with a capital P in Thomas Aquinas. And you can see what's happening in this period. Political, military power influenced by the church, the new intellectual power. Aquinas was a Dominican. The Dominicans became the great professors of the day. The Franciscans were the other order of friars who were kind of like the InterVarsity and Campus Crusade of the day. These were the campus ministries, we could say. And they became the faculties of the universities at that time. So the church is influencing these recoveries of these different areas of civilization. When political power emerged as the centralized government began to be realized, particularly in France and England, the Holy Roman Empire is a little different. It's really too big for its time. And the person who's Holy Roman Emperor has a nominal kind of recognition over a large territory. In this map, this boundary here shows the Holy Roman Empire, and you can see it's basically Germany, but includes a good bit of Italy. Also, in the days of Charles V, because he was heir to some lands in Spain and also in the Netherlands, it included some of the most important economic and commercial areas as well. But it's too big to govern with the kinds of mechanisms of government that existed at that time. The effective ones are moving out from Paris under the King of France or out of London under the King of England.